In session, Judge Riley, Judge Werkey, Judge Bradfold, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding. The first case this morning is A-19-2084, State of Minnesota versus Paul Scott Seaman.
And good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I think you probably both have done oral arguments now via Zoom, so you know that it's the same as if we were in the courtroom. You each have 15 minutes and 5 minutes for rebuttal if Mr. Kohler, you decide to use that. And when you begin your oral argument, would you please state your name for the record because we are being recorded. So with that, attorney for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Dan Kohler, K-O-E-W-L-E-R, and I represent the appellant, Scott Paul Seaman, in this matter. This case has a tortured procedural history that hopefully won't come up too much. The facts are really straightforward and honestly read a bit like a Law and Order episode. Mr. Seaman was under investigation for years up until about March of 2014. And then things moved really quick.
I want to make sure that I understand the procedural process or what happened below. So we have matters 1, 2, and 3, and they involve different counts. This is an appeal from a jury verdict in matter 1, but as I understand it, at the suppression hearing or the omnibus hearing, all of the suppression issues were going to be dealt with at the same time. Is that right, or is it just matter 1?
And the state can correct me, they're more familiar with the nuts and bolts of the district court, but my understanding was that it was just matter 1. Some issues from matter 2 were also combined. Matter 3 held its own omnibus hearing, I believe, late last year. So this, for the purposes of appeal, the way I'm interpreting the orders that have come down is that we are just appealing the omnibus orders that affected, and the judicial orders that affected matter 1.
I need to ask for a clarification, Mr. Kohler. I understand the appeal is only as to matter 1, but as I understand the file, the genesis for the search warrant, the probable cause that led to the search warrant as it relates to matter 1 overlapped. It was over all 36 charges, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, just so I'm clear.
But then, so then my question has to do with the third search warrant, or I'll call, I think it's the third, with regard to the cell phone. So are you asking us to consider that search warrant also?
On appeal today, no. We're for matter one, we're strictly looking at the original search warrant, which was based almost exclusively on the statements made by Tyler Heacock, as well as the district court relied a little bit on the poll camera evidence in upholding the warrant when it was originally challenged.
So with regard to that poll camera, when I read the affidavit for the application for the search warrant, there was one short paragraph in a rather long search warrant that dealt with the poll camera. Am I reading that right?
Yes, and there's one sentence in when appellant challenged probable cause for the issuance of the warrant to his property. There is one sentence where the court relies on the evidence from the poll camera. The way I read it is that the use of the poll camera was only to demonstrate that the Harley-Davidson did not leave the property during the monitoring. So I think it's an incredibly egregious constitutional violation. It's a case of first impression in this state. But while it's not moot, there wasn't much utilized by law enforcement when they applied for the search warrant that came from that poll camera.
So then let me ask you this. If we were to ignore that paragraph and that one sentence in the judge's order and not reach the issue of the constitutionality of the poll camera, is there enough probable cause in the warrant?
And I'm sorry, Honor, could you repeat the question?
I understand that you have problems with Mr. Heacock's statements to law enforcement, but if we were to ignore that short paragraph in the affidavit and the one line in the judge's order about probable cause, is there enough independent probable cause in the application or affidavit for the warrant to support probable cause?
So, and I'm not firing on all cylinders, and I apologize. Is the court asking if we disregard the poll camera as though it didn't exist?
Yes.
Would there still be sufficient probable cause?
Yes.
I honestly believe so.
Okay.
Well, here's what I'm trying to figure out. What evidence was derived from the poll camera? That's, you know, the state is arguing there is no, using the fruit of the poisonous tree and so on, that there was nothing that came as a result. So as it relates to this matter one, what are you looking to be suppressed that was derived from that? The poll camera.
It would solely be the statement that there was no evidence that the Harley-Davidson left the property. It's not, there's not a lot there. But it's not moot. I mean, it was put in the search warrant. The judge did specifically, when she upheld the warrant, rely on the fact that the poll camera did see that nothing left, but it's not de minimis, but it's low. And I think that that's obvious. But the primary evidence that supported the warrant was the statements made by Tyler Heacock. And that's where everything moved incredibly quick. I mean, the camera was put up on March 24th. Mr. Seaman was arrested solely, I believe, on obstruction of legal process about a month later. And it was within days of that that Mr. Heacock, excuse me, Mr. Heacock allegedly reached out to law enforcement to give them information, came in the next day. And I say allegedly because it is an inference, but it's a credible inference, because it was a day or two before that there's undisputed evidence law enforcement went into Mr. Seaman's phone, deleted the recording he made of his arrest for obstruction of legal process, and also actively searched the phone, including contacts with Mr. Heacock. On TV, that type of coincidence makes sense. It keeps the story moving. But it's difficult to believe that Mr. Heacock suddenly decided he needed to reach out to law enforcement and then come in and meet the next day, you know, within 24 hours of a warrantless search of Mr. Seaman's phone, a warrantless search that didn't get any reference at all in the search warrant application. And that's why Mr. Seaman's asking for this evidentiary hearing. The statements were made that this was purely conclusory, that there's not enough there to warrant a Franks hearing. And frankly, I believe that that's not only wrong under a de novo standard of review, but it's an abuse of discretion.
So I mean, as I understand the record, your client and his son, Mr. Heacock, had a falling out after the son had been living with him for 6 months, more or less.
That's what's stated in the application for the search warrant, yes.
And Mr. Heacock was unable to retrieve whatever personal property he had at his dad's place. And the application said that's why he went to the police. I'm just wondering, so in the record, what is the evidence to support your contention that he didn't, or he had incentives to come forward to speak with law enforcement or didn't come forward voluntarily?
It's an inference from the evidence. There's no smoking gun that's an email saying, hey, you know, we dug through his phone, we found this contact, we got to get a hold of him. And then a response saying, yeah, just to be safe, let's not mention that we contacted him or anything like that. I mean, there is no smoking gun in that respect. It is an inference. But focusing on that too much, and the court was right, you need to draw a nexus in order to have a Franks hearing. But I mean, there is undisputed evidence that they were sifting through his phone and deleting files right after his arrest. And at that point in time, that was known to be unconstitutional. And so I don't think it's too far of a leap at all to make that inference, at least to the point where an evidentiary hearing can be held. I mean, the state's not arguing that Carney from Carney Forensics, who has, you know, spoken at the American Academy of Forensic Sciences and totally laid out his credentials and methodology in his affidavit, they're not claiming anything he said in there is wrong. The BCA hasn't come in to say, we reviewed his methodology and that's nonsense. He's making stuff up. Like, it's undisputed at this point that law enforcement did this. The question is, can you draw enough inferences to undermine the information that led the court to issue the warrant in the first place? Given the fact that law enforcement didn't mention that they went through this phone without a warrant, I think that calls everything else into question. And given that it's a little suspect, there's plausible explanations for Mr. Heacock approaching law enforcement. There's one in the application itself, but that needs to be explored in an evidentiary hearing. There's already enough here where it looks like he's getting railroaded, like Mr. Seaman's getting railroaded, not to give him a hearing on this. So that's what we're asking for, is for this to be remanded for an evidentiary hearing where Mr. Carney can testify, because that is the nexus. And that was the rationale provided by the district court in, rationale of the district court in denying the reopening was that defense counsel below didn't draw that nexus between the evidence and what could undermine the search warrant. But the fact is that if they used the evidence from Mr. Seaman's phone to initiate contact with Tyler Heacock, I mean, that's more misrepresentations right there. We don't know what happened during that conversation. Mr. Heacock would likely be called to testify at an omnibus hearing. That needs to be explored. And that's the nexus that wasn't properly raised, but was implied by defense counsel below.
So my understanding is that the search warrant application itself contains no inference that the law enforcement used any information, relied on any information that was obtained from the search of Seaman's phone, right?
Correct.
And so I looked for cases where you have, other than the perhaps unconstitutional use of the poll camera information, there's nothing else in this affidavit. It's that they omitted information. It's not that it contained information. Is that right?
Omission of material information, yes.
So they omitted information. They took Heacock's information and corroborated it by talking with people in Colorado and Montana and Harley Davidson, and then use that information to obtain a search warrant from a judge. And so you're suggesting that the remedy for searching the phone without a warrant, we'll assume that's true, is to suppress all the evidence from these search warrants.
If that's how things develop at the evidentiary hearing, yes. I mean, and independently, we're arguing that the district court erred in finding probable cause in the first place due to the staleness of the information. Assuming they didn't search the cell phone on its face, that's our first argument, is that it still lacked probable cause. But our primary argument is issue two, and that's the fact that, yes, because of the blatant violation of Mr. Seaman's constitutional rights, almost everything in that warrant is tainted. And at that point,
Mr. Kohler, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I thought you were asking that the matter be sent back for an additional omnibus evidentiary hearing on that issue of the cell phone. Is that what you're asking for, or are you asking us to outright suppress? And if we're suppressing, what is it we're suppressing from the cell phone?
And I know yes, you're- Yes, Your Honor. I believe, let me double check the brief so I don't misspeak if I misspoke the first time, but I believe our original argument was that regardless of the search of the cell phone, we were asking for the initial issue that was raised at the first omnibus hearing, the non-reopened one, was a challenge to probable cause to issue the warrant. We've preserved that challenge. So we are asking the court to say that no, this search warrant lacked probable cause. The grounds were that the information provided was too stale, that the search warrant was too vague. But again, our primary argument has to do with asking to reopen the omnibus hearing. But the appeal does also cover the original appeal of the first omnibus hearing, which I believe was held in April of 2015 or 2016.
Thank you, Mr. Kohler. I see that your time is up and you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, Terrence Swihart, Assistant Rice County Attorney, on behalf of respondent, State of Minnesota. Just as a preliminary matter, Your Honors, at full disclosure, this is my first actual oral argument by Zoom, so I'll hopefully get along without any hitches. Thank you for the time. Just this matter is been going on for a long time. It's a convoluted case, and I'll do my best to present the court with some background. Matter one and two relates to counts two and three, which arose out of an August 5th, 2013 warrant. So you actually have a warrant before an August, before the May 5th, 2014. Count three arose out of that May 5th, 2014 warrant. If you look at the judge's district court's orders, she does clarify that matters, that her orders relate to matters one and two only, not to matter three. That's just a little bit of a background with respect to those warrants and the criminal charges arising out of the warrants. If it's only related to matter one, that's fine. I just wanted to clarify that for the court. Another significant piece that's relevant to the cell phone issue is that the phone that appellant relies on heavily was not in the possession of the investigating agency. So in this case, all 36 counts were investigated by Rice County Sheriff's Office. April 26th, I believe, of 2014, Mr. Seaman was arrested by Faribault Police Department for obstruction. At that time, his phone was seized by Faribault Police Department. It was on the June 24th application, June 24th, 2014 application for the cell phone that that Detective or Investigator LaRoche indicates that he was informed by Sergeant Gleam of the Faribault Police Department that they have had in their possession in the secure evidence locker a Mr. Seaman's phone. And at that time then, Investigator LaRoche requested the warrant and the June 24, 2014 warrant. So the argument that the sheriff's office or the investigators under these 36 counts accessed the phone doesn't bear any is not credible because that phone was not in the possession of the investigating agency at the time. Even however, assuming that for some reason there is an inference that the sheriff's office accessed that phone, I don't think the affidavit from Mr. Carney reaches that point. But the district court order issued, district court issued an order in July 31st, 2015, which is a contested omnibus resulting from that. The January 5th, 2017 district court order was the result of the request to reopen that omnibus hearing. And the district court found there that it applied the Frank standard, which this court on review determines whether the court district court abuses discretion in refusing to reopen the that omnibus hearing. But again, the court district court applied the Frank standard. So in reviewing that Frank standard, the court for the first element applies a clearly erroneous review of the court's ultimate determination on Frank's. And the court-
Hey, on a Frank's hearing though, appellant would have made a an offer of proof as to the intentional nature of the omitted information. What, from your understanding, what precisely was that offer?
There was none. You mean an offer of proof regarding the cell phone?
Correct. I'm sorry.
Yes. Well, they need to, as you
indicated. I thought I missed something. That's why I'm asking what your understanding was.
No, thank you. Well, as you know, they must present a substantial preliminary showing that a false statement knowingly and intentionally was included by the officer in the warrant affidavit. I don't see where that element has been met. There's been no allegation that law enforcement made an intentional and knowingly false statement. I mean, even assuming, which I'm not conceding, but even assuming they accessed that phone, they didn't reference that within any affidavit that they made. All the affidavits were based on, for example, the first affidavit, the May 5th, 2014 affidavit was based on Heacock. It was based on Dalton Oster's statements. It was based on corroboration by Sergeant Halati, corroborating that information through discussions with Montana and Colorado.
Mr. Swihart, would you agree with me that it would be egregious for law enforcement to search a cell phone without a warrant?
Yes, I would agree with that statement. I don't agree that it happened here.
Okay, but what is the remedy then if they do that?
Well, you suppress the evidence resulting from the unlawful search. But in this case, there's no indication, no preliminary showing of what evidence was obtained. You have the statement from Mr. Carney indicating that he found circumstantial evidence of a search that occurred in that phone. I don't know what was taken from what evidence was obtained from that phone. I dispute that the phone was accessed. I don't know Mr. Carney's methodology, but going back to the Frank statement standard, in order to open for the court to reopen that evidentiary hearing, there was no showing that a false statement was knowingly and intentionally made by law enforcement in its affidavit. Again, the phone, based on the affidavits, and when you look at the affidavit for the determination of probable cause, we only look to the affidavit itself. The court does not look to what other information may have been in the possession of law enforcement. So if we only look at...
How would you classify Mr. Heacock? Is he an informant? Is he a concerned citizen? How would you classify him?
I think you can classify him in several ways. I think he was a first-time citizen informant. I think he was an informant that came forward voluntarily. I think he was also a son who was angry with his dad. His dad wouldn't give him his information, his property back, and the son, as a result, said, "That's fine, then I'm going to advise law enforcement of your criminal enterprise." But he was a first-time citizen informant, which indicates his reliability of the informant. He was also voluntarily there. It wasn't as if law enforcement said, "We've got criminal charges over your head, so please inform on your father." There's no indication that was there. There's no indication from anywhere in the record, the affidavits, of numerous affidavits, that Mr. Heacock was pressured in any way. In this case, and also the reliability of Mr. Heacock was also established through the corroboration by Sergeant Halati of the, for example, the one-ton GMC pickup truck in the 2014 affidavit. That was confirmed through discussions and with, I believe, Sterling, Colorado law enforcement. The 2002 pickup truck that Mr. Heacock referenced, that was also corroborated through discussions with Montana law enforcement.
Mr. Swihart, I want to follow up a bit. I appreciate your analysis of the reliability of the son's statements. But I want to back up a bit and talk a little more about the Franks hearing.
Sure.
You kept referring to the appellant's failure to identify a false statement by police officers. But it seems to me their theory is that there is an omission which is a different form of falsity. Is a Franks hearing appropriate in that case as well? I mean, again, assuming they can establish an omission and that it played a role. And you heard his theory. His theory is that the police used the search of the cell phone to actually reach out to the son and maybe, you know, maybe in coerce or incentivize him.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't think if the omission is the same as the standard, which is clear, a substantial preliminary showing that a false statement knowingly and intentionally was included by the affiant. In this case, they're saying they didn't include it in the affidavit, so therefore it's a false statement. I think that's a leap. I don't think there's any preliminary showing that whatever, and I'm not, again, please forgive me for repeating myself, not conceding that anyone searched the phone, but assuming that that even happened.
Right, and I'm not asking you to concede anything. Yeah. I'm really looking for your analysis of the legal issue. So would a Franks hearing be appropriate were a defendant able to establish a material omission from a search warrant where the police had relied on some information to gain the statements presented in the search warrant, but they obtained that, you know, threshold information illegally? Just as a pure hypothetical question.
I think my analysis then rely on two parts. One is the Frank standard, the intentional knowingly false statement. The omission is not the same as a knowingly and intentional false statement. Then you look to the other standard is, was there probable cause to support the warrant itself? And when you're making that analysis, we look only to the affidavit. And in the affidavit, is there a fair probability that probable cause existed for the warrant? And in this case, reviewing those six factors for whether a fair probability existed, I think that standard is met for the issuance of the warrant. So there is probable cause based on the statements within the affidavit itself. I don't think an omission reaches that level of a knowingly false statement, in essence, lying. I think one could say, well, you're splitting hairs, because if you were to not include a statement, is that lying? I don't think so as applied to the Frank standard. I think perhaps in our personal lives we may disagree, but I think that applying the Frank standard, that a knowingly and intentional false statement is different than not including information that you may have. Hopefully that answers your question, Your Honor. So in this case, with respect to the poll camera, just to address that final issue, the poll camera was, Deputy LaRoche, Investigator LaRoche testified at the omnibus hearing that the poll camera was in a public area across the street on the east side of the road. It viewed primarily the shop and all areas that were viewed were capable of being viewed from the roadway. It was in a public area. And I think the case law is clear that area of the poll camera didn't amount to a search, that it wasn't appropriate use of the poll camera. And as I think this court has raised, is there was no evidence seized or evidence obtained as a result of the poll camera. It was merely confirming what law enforcement believed, that nothing left that property. When the court reviews the probable cause standard and also the Frank standard, we believe that the district court properly ruled that there was probable cause for the search warrants, that the court properly found that the appellant did not meet the Frank standard and therefore properly denied the motion to reopen the omnibus hearing. And then also finally, the court, there was no evidence to suppress in this case. The district court addressed the poll camera briefly, but that its decision on the poll camera was appropriate. And we'd ask that this court affirm the district court's decision not to reopen the omnibus hearing. Thank you.
I'm just curious, since this case is so old and we have three matters, has it been resolved totally? I mean,
no.
Have matters two and three been tried or dismissed or?
Matter two has been tried. Matter three was scheduled for actually for a jury trial when the Supreme Court issued its order to allow the appeal to go forward in this case. So now we're on hold on matter three until the resolution of these cases.
And obviously that has nothing to do or no bearing on our decision, but I'm just curious since it's such an old case.
It's old and it's convoluted and it's difficult to understand. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Kohler.
Thank you. May it please the court, 2 points for rebuttal. The first, because this case is so convoluted, I believe that the state got this wrong, but when they started their argument talking about how this wasn't in possession or control of the Rice County Sheriff's Department, specifically, I looked it up, it's DOC ID 198 Exhibit D from December 6, 2016. There was a lot of fighting in this case over disclosure of emails. Most of them were not disclosed, but one of them that was titled Paul Seaman's phone from April 26, 2014. It was an email sent directly to investigator Paul LaRoche while they had Seaman in custody before they spoke to Tyler Heacock. That's an email communication that was disclosed by the state. So no, Rice County was very well aware that the phone was in possession and Faribault was actually asking them what to do with it.
Can you give me the date of that email again and the document number, please?
Yeah, it's document ID 198. It was one of Seaman's motions for a reopened omnibus. It's Exhibit D of that document. I also think that that's an argument that's more appropriate for the reopened hearing as to how far things go. I think the burden has been met, but I did just want to point that out. And that leads into my second point is that, not only are omissions just as important as material misstatements when it comes to Franks, but I think that's the Doyle case. I didn't cite to it. The district court's required to determine the credibility of witnesses that make statements in support of search warrant applications. Like that's a core role of the magistrate or the judge. Citizen informants get that default, you're credible, if there's certain statements made in the affidavit that were not made in this affidavit. And that's cited in the brief. But moreover, Seaman's whole argument is that the omission of the fact that they searched the phone calls into question the credibility of everything Mr. Heacock said. We're assuming he reached out to law enforcement. He's not involved in the criminal underworld. He wasn't threatened. He's not getting anything in exchange for providing this information. And that's the assumption we're making because we're also assuming law enforcement didn't go through Paul Seaman's phone. And we know that's not true. As I stated, Mr. Carney's methodology was well spelled out in his affidavit, as were his credentials, as were his findings and conclusions. And again, the state has done nothing other than to say no to refute the fact that this phone was definitely searched. And there's also evidence, like, you know, unequivocal evidence that Rice County was told about it as soon as Faribault had it in their possession. I think under those standards, it would be a miscarriage of justice not to let Mr. Seaman explore this at an evidentiary hearing. I think it was error under de novo standard of review. I also think on this record, it was an abuse of discretion to deny reopening the omnibus, whichever standard the court chooses to go with. And that's why we're primarily asking this court to reverse his conviction in matter one and remand for an omnibus hearing. Barring that, I'm not going to say in the alternative because I got them backwards, but in the alternative, we're asking the court to reverse the conviction and throw out the search warrant without getting to the cell phone issue. That was our first issue, but I do think the primary issue in this case deals with reopening the omnibus for a Franks hearing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. It's an interesting case, even if it is convoluted, your words, not ours. Mr. Swihart, I hope that your first Zoom oral argument was an okay experience for you, and we we will get our order out within the 90 days. Thank you very much.
Thank you.